Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Then put your little hand in mine.
Here we go again.
Punxsutawney Phil.
That's right, woodchuck chuckers. It's Groundhog Day. Get up and...
On Groundhog Day, we ask the really big questions.
If you only had one day to live, I mean, the whole world is about to explode. What do you do?
Groundhogs. A creature becomes a holiday, becomes a movie, becomes a religious text. Bill Murray as an apostle of redemption?
Am I right or am I right? Or am I right? Am I right?
I kid you not. Stay tuned on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 2nd. Happy Groundhog's Day. And The Takeaway this morning is going to be a religious discussion of the religious significance of the movie Groundhog Day later on this hour.
Because of the weather predictions?
No, it is an amazing story. It's an amazing conversation. Stay tuned.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Medical evacuation flights for injured Haitians are now in the air again after U.S. officials decided to fly the wounded to several states so that Florida will not be overwhelmed. They'd been suspended since last week, those flights, when Florida Governor Charlie Crist said the state's hospitals were reaching the saturation point.
Florida never said that we wanted to stop taking Haitians. All we said was that we would appreciate help in being able to continue to help our friends from the island. And that's exactly what has happened.
Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Mark McKinney, chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. He told us local medical teams in Haiti need to take charge.
The Haitians are starting to identify us as the caregivers and are starting to send over more patients. The exit strategy is not clear. We're on the ground right now, but we need to help set up Haitians who can take care of the Haitian people.
The American Red Cross says a waiting list for aid deliveries into Haiti is over 1,000 flights long.
Wow. Haiti's prime minister says those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents should be put on trial for child trafficking. He says the religious group knew it was breaking the law since some of the children have surviving parents. For a quick update on this story, George Prentice joins us now. He's a reporter and host for Boise State Radio, where the church in question is based. George, a church with a busload of kids and some questionable paperwork there in Haiti. Is this a case of bureaucracy down there or over-exuberant missionaries who believe they are doing God's work?
Well, the answers, I guess, would be yes and yes if you ask two different people. There's very little middle ground. Some say God wanted them to go to Haiti, and others are saying it's incredibly wrong-headed and no wonder the world hates us.
Another religious story. We're going to get to the bottom of it in just a moment. George Prentice, stay with us.
Now for the latest on that massive Toyota recall. Toyota President Jim Lentz says a small steel shim about the size of a postage stamp is all that's needed to permanently fix the problem with accelerators.
The parts will be arriving in dealerships. If not late on Tuesday, they will begin arriving on Wednesday. All of the training should be completed by the end of the week, so they will start working on consumer vehicles this weekend.
Toyota says the repairs will take about a half an hour.
Oscar nominations have just come out. They're too numerous to name, but we'll give you a few. We'll give you some highlights. We're going to talk about it later on in the program. Best Picture, Avatar, Up in the Air, The Hurt Locker, Morgan Freeman and George Clooney up for Best Actor. Sandra Bullock made the cut for Best Actress. Meryl Streep got a nomination. Big surprise. For Best Director, James Cameron, his wife Catherine, ex-wife Catherine Bigelow, and Quentin Tarantino were all nominated. And it's Groundhog Day. Not terribly good news. Punxsutawney Phil, America's favorite rodent, saw his shadow in Pennsylvania, meaning we're in for another 6 weeks of winter. Didn't move the markets, though. Asian and European markets are up, so are futures. The Dow gets underway at 10,185. The S&P opens at 1,089. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,171. We're going to talk more about that favorite film of so many religious scholars and faith leaders.
If you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
The World According to Groundhog Day. Yes, the movie with Bill Murray. We're not kidding. The conversation's coming up later in the hour.
I think Disney would argue that Punxsutawney Phil is not the country's favorite rodent. But we're also talking about the unemployment unemployed today. How do you help your friends who are unemployed? What's the most useful thing you can do? Or if you're unemployed, what's the best thing you would ask from your friends? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
We With all of the headlines coming out of Haiti since the devastating earthquake 3 weeks ago, this has become an international incident. The question of what the Central Valley Baptist Church workers were doing with a busload of Haitian kids at the border of the Dominican Republic without proper documentation. The church members have been detained. There are now questions about what they were actually trying to do with the kids. Here's Clint Henry, the pastor of the Central Valley Baptist Church, speaking yesterday.
We were not trying to traffic children. We were simply trying to minister to a desperate situation there in that country, and we had a facility that could be used to do that temporarily.
Haitian authorities, on the other hand, say the group didn't have proper documentation for the children, and they say some of the children weren't even orphans. The group, based in Idaho, says, as you heard there, they were only trying to help. Getting to the bottom of this is difficult, and we're rejoined by George Prentice, a reporter and host for Boise State Radio in Idaho, who laid out there at the top of the hour just how difficult it is to get clarity here. You're feeling that as well as a reporter, right, George?
You bet. Definitely both sides of the issue, but very little middle ground.
All right. Michelle Montaz is a former U.N. spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, a former director of Radio Haiti, and she's a Haitian journalist. Good morning to you, Michelle.
Good morning, John.
Let's talk about, first of all, how this is being reported down in Haiti.
Well, you know, I think it is being reported for what it is. I mean, those, you know, no matter what their intentions were, those were people trying to take children out at a time when, you know, there are a number of cases of children being trafficked out of Haiti. There are a number of reports that were alarming. And there are the reason why it was done is because they didn't have proper documentation. I also know of a number of orphans who have left with proper documentation. They were, their papers were signed by the Prime Minister himself so they could go. So some have left on a regular basis, on a legal basis.
Indeed. And since the earthquake, the Prime Minister has to sign for every child who leaves the country. George Prentice, what is the reputation of the Central Valley Baptist Church? And would you expect them to be involved in something like this, you know, that's not above board?
Well, the church is a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's the country's largest Protestant denomination. They're also known for humanitarian programs. But this particular initiative was a nonprofit. A couple of ladies started it called the New Life Children's Refuge, and they just started it last fall. So this is pretty loosey-goosey right now.
Now, when you say loosey-goosey, it means it's not accredited, it's not clear what the mission is, or these are people who are so imbued with the sense of doing God's work that maybe they're inclined to break the rules?
Certainly, while they are accredited, there is no defined mission, and one of the members who is actually being detained in Haiti right now says God wanted us to come here to help children.
Well, that can't be helpful to shorten their detention, I would imagine, at this point. Michelle Montaz, what is the interest of the Haitian government in trying to keep the impression from getting out that basically Haiti's children aren't safe in Haiti and that they need to be sent outside of the country?
Well, no one, it has nothing to do with the government. No one is safe in Haiti. We had a tremendous event that occurred on January 12th. We had an earthquake. And we have aftershocks, and there are credible information that there might be more and more severe ones. So everyone's at risk in Haiti. However, you know, some children who lost their parents the day after the earthquake or the day of the earthquake, you know, some of the parents have been trying to trace their children, and they have found them, okay? And everything is being done to help parents trace their children and find them, okay? So to me, the fact that there is the impression that, you know, Haiti needs help. However, it's not a reason to go beyond the law. It has nothing to do with the government. It has to do with the law of the country.
Michelle Montaz, a former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York and a Haitian journalist speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. You know, is it possible that this organization will get the chance to make their paperwork right? Or do you think that organizations are coming to Haiti and taking advantage of the situation?
I think somehow. some are. Some have been very, very helpful. And all the children who had their paperwork already in the pipeline, they were all given the possibility to go and join their adoptive families in the States or elsewhere. So there is a process which was ongoing. Right now, it's a bit difficult to initiate new processes because, as you know, most of the judicial system, at least in Port-au-Prince, collapsed. But, however, there is a judge that heard these missionaries, and the process is ongoing. Whether they can be tried in Haiti or in the States, it's something that has not been determined yet. For the time being, they were breaking Haitian law.
Right. Well, let's listen to here's a George Willett, who you may have seen on some of the cable programs, who's been speaking publicly. He's from the SOS orphanage in Haiti. And the Associated Press interviewed him talking about some of the children who were obtained from the custody of the Central Valley Baptist Church. And he describes, first of all, their situation. Listen to this.
I'm not an orphan. I do have my parents. I thought I'm going to a boarding school or to a summer camp. We don't know it exactly, to the Dominican Republic. Babies which were dehydrated, we have had the Red Cross here. And one of these little babies, it might be 2 or 3 months old, we had to bring it immediately to the hospital.
George Prentice, do you have any sense there in Boise if this church has attempted to intercede to U.S. authorities to try to get themselves released?
Well, I can tell you that the Idaho congressional delegation, our two senators and two House members, came out with what could easily be considered a carefully crafted statement, saying that they were in touch with the State Department, et cetera, to represent the interests, if you will, of the Central Valley Baptist Church.
So, George, you're all over this story. What do you want people around the country to know about the relationship between this group and your community?
Other Northwest adoption agencies are really concerned about the shadow this is casting on them. They're saying the last thing that anyone would want is for a child to come here and then find out that father or mother is actually alive.
All right. George Prentice, reporter and host for Boise State Radio, which is where Central Valley Baptist Church is located. The individuals from that church are being detained. Michelle Montaz, thanks so much for being with us.
You're most welcome, John.
Michelle is former UN spokeswoman for the Secretary General in New York, and she's working in Haiti trying to sort out the situation there as a Haitian journalist and also spokesperson for the government. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the top stories we're following.
President Obama will try to sell his economic agenda and re-energize voters when he travels to New Hampshire today. While he's there, he'll tour a local business and hold his second town hall in 6 days. The president is also urging Congress to approve his $3.8 trillion budget. That raises the deficit to a record $1.6 trillion. But the president says right now he needs to focus on stimulating the economy, not reducing the deficit. We've been talking about Haiti all morning. Now the U.S. military will begin flying injured survivors to several U.S. hospitals. That's after Florida's governor said his state's hospitals were being overloaded. Yesterday, the federal government announced it will reimburse American hospitals treating earthquake victims. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Anita Roldan, president of Jackson Health System in Miami. She says some aspects of the reimbursement are unclear.
Well, we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. Know that this is as of yesterday, so it is moving forward.
Meanwhile, in Haiti, hundreds of people have organized the first political demonstration since the disaster. They want Haitian President Reynald Préval to resign.
Certainly people in South Florida paying attention to that story, and we welcome our new South Florida listeners on WLRN this week. Toyota will use a small steel shim to repair vehicles affected by the massive recall. The repair will take about a half hour per car. The problem is costing the automaker about $155 million a week in lost sales. The groundhog saw his shadow, another 6 weeks of winter. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the movie Groundhog Day. It's a religious text.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'll take three news takeouts, and two of them are right here in the studio. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is also here with a sports takeout a little bit later in the segment. Good morning.
Good morning.
Louise, let's begin with you. The inspector general, a guy by the name of Neil Barofsky. I'm sure he's a fine, fine fellow, but these inspector generals are sort of paid to be very, very critical. Had a controversial thing to say about the TARP program. He is actually the person who is responsible for oversight of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, along with some others. But Neil Barofsky described the TARP as having saved our financial system from driving off a cliff back in 2008, but absent meaningful reform, we are still, the U.S. economy, driving on the same winding mountain road, but this time in a faster car. It sounds like he's warning that we're in worse shape, maybe, than we were a year ago.
He is, John. What he's saying is that, you know, this too big to fail thing we've set up where everyone assumes now that if a bank gets in trouble, the government will bail it out, actually has the moral hazard of perhaps encouraging banks to take more risk because they know that they'll be saved. This guy, Neil Barofsky, is really interesting. He's kind of like the Kenneth Starr, you know, from the Clinton administration.
Right, sure.
He's a former U.S. attorney, and you know what he used to do was fight Colombian drug lords.
Oh, so
he's an interesting, tough person.
Yeah.
In fact, he apparently keeps the knife from someone who tried to kill him down in Colombia over his former work. So these banks, you know, should be a little afraid of him. But he has really taken some tough positions. He's accused the former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson of misleading the public about how bad the situation was in 08. He's been the only one who's required the banks under oath to tell us exactly how they spent those bailout funds. And so now for him to take this position that really nothing has changed, the government has not put anything meaningful in place to rein these banks in, either with pay or with financial reform. And he says that's very dangerous.
Well, demoralizing, and we will see if anything happens as a result of this Inspector General report. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks.
Our next takeout comes to us from the laboratories of the University of Michigan. We have with us Sean Morrison. He's the director of the school's Center for Stem Cell Biology. And they think they've identified a frightening trend in research that could lead to some major breakthroughs in Parkinson's, cancer, or multiple sclerosis treatments. Joining us is Sean Morrison. So, Sean, what is it you found as you looked through the current stem cell research?
Well, under the Bush administration policy, very few stem cell lines were available for research. And of those, nobody really knew which human populations they were derived from. So we tested the most commonly used lines genetically and found that the vast majority of the lines were of European origin. A few were from the Middle East, probably from Israeli populations, and a few were from Asia. But they did not represent the diversity in our society, and there were certain populations that were notably underrepresented, like anybody of African descent.
Why does it matter? Is there make a difference between one cell and another?
Well, a fundamental principle of medical research is that we test new therapies on diverse patients because we never know when therapies could affect patients from different human populations differently. And so if embryonic stem cell research has the potential to change the future of medicine, we should be able to study diverse lines to make sure that the therapies that are developed have the intended effects in diverse backgrounds.
Do you know why we don't have diverse stem cells, and does that help you know how to fix it?
Well, in the first instance, we just needed to derive lines to be able to do the research, and we had very few available. Now, under the new National Institutes of Health policy, many new lines will be available to federally funded researchers, and now's the time when we can start considering issues like ensuring appropriate diversity exists out there. And for, I think, one of the steps that will be necessary would be to derive new lines for underrepresented groups, such as from people of African descent, to make sure that they're adequately represented in the research, and that's something we'd like to do at the University of Michigan.
That's interesting. Thanks so much. Sean Morrison is the director of the University of Michigan's Center for Stem Cell Biology.
Well, he's counting the hours here in the studio. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Super Bowl is on Sunday, right?
Yes, exciting.
And every day leading up to the Super Bowl, we're going to profile interesting players who have great stories to tell. We also have a basketball milestone in a moment. But first, the Saints, Jahari Evans, is that how you pronounce
Jahari
his name?
Evans.
Jahari Evans. What's the story with him?
So he's an offensive lineman, which is he protects the quarterback.
Got
and
it.
He plays for the New Orleans Saints. In 2006, he came to the New Orleans Saints, which was a band of misfits. And he had previously been at Bloomsburg in Pennsylvania, which is a small Division II school, which is not quite the place that you normally get an NFL prospect. In high school, he had badly fractured his leg. Nobody was looking at him. So he ended up at this Division II school. He excels at this Division II school. And then somehow scouts came around him and picked him up, and they pulled him up. And the Saints took a chance on him. As a rookie, because of injuries to the veterans, he immediately was thrust into the starting position. And now he's on a team of destiny.
And he's an All-Pro.
He's an All-Pro.
So he goes from fractured knee at a bad school to essentially a walk-on with the Saints, the misfit Saints. And now he's an All-Pro on his way to the Super Bowl.
And when he was in high school, he was a top 10 in his class. He had well over 1,000 in the SATs. So he's also a very likable guy. He really took to Bloomsburg. He goes back every year. He does a camp for offensive linemen. And at the beginning of the season, we talked about the importance of offensive linemen. And with a guy like quarterback Drew Brees behind you, you have to have a solid offensive line, and he's the anchor of that line.
He's the protector. Can you book him on the show? Sounds like a great guy.
He does sound like a great guy.
Give him a call. All right, get started on that. But let's talk about this milestone. Kobe Bryant becomes the Lakers' all-time points leader with 44 points last night.
He has more points than George Mikan, Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Wilt Chamberlain. And for the NBA franchise that's arguably one of the most dominant franchises in sports history,
sure,
the Los Angeles Lakers, now Kobe Bryant is the leading scorer out of that group, and that's an astounding achievement.
That is so huge. Is that because of his longevity? Is that because of his per-game average? What?
I think it's also because he started before all of them. He came straight out of high school, so let's not forget that.
Okay, so he had that advantage.
Exactly.
But it's still an enormous milestone. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, thanks so much. Those are your takeouts. Coming up, we've been talking about how to rebuild Haiti. Today we talk about rebuilding housing. More in just a few minutes.
Coming up, the problem in Haiti, do you build something quickly that gets people shelter right away, or do you build something that can withstand the hurricanes that are coming and the years ahead? We're going to talk about that in a few moments. Also, all day today, we're thinking about how to help the unemployed. When one of them is your friend or your family member, how do you help them? What kind of assistance do you offer? Or if you are unemployed, what do you need?
This is Brian from KPAC, and we helped out my cousin and his family. I went up to the school and I paid for his son for the whole lunch for the whole year. And I did it for his daughter, too.
Wow, that's a really great offer of help. Let us know your story at 8778-MYTAKE or post it on our site, thetakeaway.org. Here's some of the news stories that we're following at 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama's budget may face an early test this week on Capitol Hill. His proposed tax credit for small businesses could come up for a vote in the Senate by Friday. Today, White House Budget Director Peter Orszag will appear before Congress to explain the ballooning deficit.
We don't want to act too rapidly to bring down the deficit because that would exacerbate the jobs deficit.
Also this morning, the president heads to New Hampshire to promote his idea to send $30 billion to community banks so they can help small businesses.
U.S. military now says it will fly injured Haitian earthquake survivors to several states to avoid overloading Florida. Florida Governor Charlie Crist describes the cost incurred by his state.
After about 3 days, it was about $1.7 million. After about a week, it was $7.1 million. And we're probably at approximately $10 million to date.
Federal government says it will reimburse hospitals who treat earthquake victims from Haiti. Meanwhile, Haitian officials are considering a trial for those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law and that some of the children have surviving parents. Here at home, the Academy Award nominations are out. Avatar and Hurt Locker lead with 9 nominations each. Best Picture and Director for James Cameron of Avatar. Other nominees include Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side, Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart, Monique for Precious, and Matt Damon for Invictus. In a shocking development, Meryl Streep was nominated again, 16th time for her, adding to her record that just doesn't stop. Markets are open. Dow is up about 11 points. The S&P up about a point and a half, and same for the NASDAQ after futures were marginally up all morning long. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday on the show, we started a conversation about how Haiti can transform itself and transition from rescue efforts into long-term rebuilding. We spoke to economist Paul Collier about that process, and we asked him what the triggers are for long-term economic sustainability.
First, let's look for
sustainable housing. So not tents, but simple one-room buildings that can then be expanded down the line. Let's look for those houses to be located in places where economic opportunity can be built.
Okay, how does you actually make that happen? We have somebody here with the answers to that question. Andreas Duwani is an architect from Miami. He was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina, and he just returned from Haiti 2 days ago. Good morning, Andreas.
Hello, good morning.
So do you agree with what you just heard from economist Paul Collier, that you need to find simple, sustainable building solutions so that that eventually leads to long-term recovery?
No, I think so. I think actually just about every idea for the time being is a good one. But in the end, the one sustainable thing, given the very large numbers and problems, the scale of the problems, is to harness the energy of the people, you know, the people themselves and their smarts. You know, I think the Haitians, from what I could tell, were clever, self-organizing people that, given the chance, will dig themselves out.
Okay, but this is an urgent issue at the moment because you have two warring problems. You have, number one, an issue of urgency that people need shelter now. Hurricane season is coming. Rains are coming. Mm-hmm. And the other is that you have to build something, some kind of structures for them that can actually survive hurricane season.
Well, there are lots of structures. And I was studying aerial photography yesterday, from Google. You should know that Google Earth has actually photographed Port-au-Prince after the hurricane. After the earthquake.
Wow.
You know, they have very recent photographs. And what's astonishing is the pattern of masonry buildings haven't fallen. You know, what most people visit is the downtown with masonry buildings, but then you look at the shanty towns on the hillside, which are built out of more resilient materials, you know, metal and wood, and what you find is huge areas that are intact. And these are the kinds of structures that people from the outside never consider. You know, they always consider, let's have the permanent solid structures. And, while there's a huge areas of shanty towns that have not yet been visited, you know, I've asked people and said, no, we haven't penetrated that area. We don't know what's happening there. But the aerial photography shows that entire areas have survived. And these are the hand-built structures of the people themselves.
So rather than bringing in tents, should we be investing in structures that can be put up very quickly and easily and, I assume, inexpensively, that perhaps can survive the elements?
Well, no, I don't think there's a rather. I think we need to build in tents. We need to bring in tents, and we need to bring in prefabricated buildings of all technologies. But when you think about that the largest, proposals are maybe 500 units, 1,000 units, and there could easily be 100,000 and 200,000 people in need of housing, I think that the answer is everything must be done, but not least let people build for themselves the way they're used to. Even if to our eyes it looks incredibly impoverished, you know, and incredibly sad, you know, those little shanty town structures are really survived.
No, and they have experience. They have experience in precisely those conditions. I guess, we've talked with people from Architecture for Humanity on this program, and they talk a good game about what's needed in Haiti. I'm wondering if there's a way to create what Paul Collier talked about yesterday, this sort of staircase of architecture, where you begin with a tent, but then the tent becomes part of maybe a building that becomes more of a traditional shanty dwelling. That so you can actually accumulate a dwelling rather than having to constantly throw things away.
Well, I think so. I'm not sure that tents can grow, but I do think that, for example, a pile of bulk deliveries of 2x4s, and piles of corrugated iron, which is what they make the roofs and walls out of. Corrugated steel, and maybe wire to slash things together. Just delivering piles of these things would actually yield to a lot of energy being applied, by people themselves. Now there is one caveat, which is these are very poor people, and they're it's more likely than not that they'll just sell the stuff, that will become into a kind of form of very minor graft. So we have two contradictory things here. We have the people's ability to do for themselves, but also the need to make sure that they land in the right things.
Now, how is this different than the experience that you had in rebuilding Katrina? Are you seeing some of the same issues?
Well, no, Katrina, the little houses, the so-called Katrina cottages, of which 3,000, for example, were delivered in Mississippi, those are palaces by Haiti standards, The very wealthiest people live in what in Mississippi is a temporary Katrina cottage. So, you know, I've designed already four types of housing for, you know, almost one a day. And what I have to do is recalibrate downwards. You know, I designed something that seems very simple and very, you know, and then I realize that these people are even poorer than that. This morning I read about a woman in the New York Times that built, that had an 8-foot by 8-foot shelter built for four people for $60.
Wow.
You know, and even after 4 days, I have not calibrated downwards to that.
But could it withstand a hurricane? That's the question. Andreas Duwani, architect and planner from Miami, he's involved. He was involved in the reconstruction after Katrina.
It's Ecumenical Day. That's right. Otherwise called Groundhog Day. Coming up, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and more unite. Today is for all of you. The religious significance of Groundhog Day, the movie. We're going to talk about how the movie is really an intersection for many faiths. I'm serious. Later on this hour. You got us, babe.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This story gets you really thinking. Okay, imagine we play a game of tennis, right? We sit down and we go, man, you know what I feel like? A cold Joe Stalin.
What?
Soda. That's right. In Russia, they've started producing Joseph Stalin-logoed sodas to mark a World War II military anniversary. What would such a thing taste like? What would it look like? Why would you even reach for one? But Boris Maximov of our partner, the BBC's Russian service, joined us earlier to explain it all. I asked Boris how much rehabilitation Joseph Stalin needs, since it sounds like he's doing pretty well.
He's doing pretty well because there's been a fairly concerted campaign over the last 10 years from the authorities, from the top down, to kind of rehabilitate him. For example, you know, they changed the history school books because history is being taught as a compulsory subject for all the children in schools. And they rewrote them, and now it mentions in one sentence that he did kill quite a few people, but how many exactly is disputed. And then it stresses that he was a very effective manager. And sure, he was not perfect, but he was very good at running the country.
This is what the school books say. Not, it doesn't say that on the drink bottle or anything.
No, but for example, as a result of that campaign, it's been going on for almost 10 years now, or trying to rehabilitate an idea of a strong, effective leader who will save the country and move it somewhere, guess whom they're hinting at. There was the campaign to restore Stalin to at least some kind of glory. So his pictures suddenly appeared at least on one subway station in Moscow recently. One of his statues recently appeared somewhere. There was vodka called Stalin for quite a few years now. And if you listen to opinion polls, for example, in Russia, ordinary Russians are being asked who in history, in Russian history, in 20th century or 19th century, was one of the main great heroes of the country, they invariably mention Stalin in the top three or four. And in the latest opinion poll on the subject, they mention Stalin and Solzhenitsyn at exactly the same level, which is kind of somewhat ironic because Solzhenitsyn spent his time denouncing Stalin's crimes.
Now, you know, Lenin, of course, has been a trade figure for quite a long time. Why do you think this particular brewery took, or particular beverage manufacturer took this step?
Because they read the same opinion poll. As I just quoted you, and if somebody is popular, so it's not at least among a larger section of population.
No, I understand, but why are they first? Why did they step out first? Do they have a reputation for being conservative or a reputation for being edgy?
Neither. They just want to be popular. Because I told you, there's Stalin vodka been around for a while, and not just in Russia. I've seen a Coca-Cola bottling plant in neighboring Georgia that produced simultaneously Coca-Cola and vodka called Stalin.
So, Boris Maximov, what does Stalin, the drink, taste like?
Well, I suspect that it tastes a lot of like any other soft drink, kind of gassy chemical.
A gassy chemical. But, I mean, is it going to be really sweet, or is it going to be sort of sour?
Of course it is sweet. Russians have a sweet tooth. You know, give enough sweetness and enough drink, and the country's happy.
So next time you go back to Moscow, you're going to bring some out?
Probably not. There are better things to take out from there.
That was Boris Maximov, BBC Russian Service editor. He joined us from Bush House in London, where he was imagining having a nice cold Stalin, a nice cold Joe Stalin.
That crisp taste.
With lunch, yes. Refresh yourself with Joe Stalin. Gassy chemical. the gassy chemical of the of a new generation.
Okay, okay. Let's just stop
Keep
that
it going.
There.
I can't stop. I can't stop. Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and we begin with a question from the Book of Murray.
If you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
That, of course, is Bill Murray from the movie Groundhog Day. We're going to talk about the significance of this Bill Murray flick. It's actually been embraced by many religions. We'll talk about why in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama will try to sell his economic agenda when he travels to New Hampshire today. While there, he'll tour a local business and hold his second town hall meeting in 6 days. The president is urging Congress to approve his nearly $4 trillion budget, which raises the deficit to $1.6 trillion. But still, the president says the budget isn't wasteful.
We've gone through every department spending line by line, item by item, looking for inefficiency, duplication, and programs that have outlived their usefulness.
The president's budget includes $300 billion for recession relief and job creation.
Moving to Haiti now, the U.S. military will begin flying injured earthquake victims to American hospitals in several states to avoid overloading Florida. The federal government will reimburse hospitals for treatment that they provide as well. In entertainment, producer David Brown has died. David Brown was married to Cosmopolitan editor Helen Gurley Brown. He was 93, and he was nominated for the Best Picture Oscar 4 times and brought films like Jaws and A Few Good Men to the big screen. And this year's Oscar nominations are out. Some of the nominees for Best Picture, there are 10 of them, so we'll only name a few: Avatar, The Blind Side, and The Hurt Locker. And finally, winter, not over yet, if you believe Punxsutawney Phil, the weather-predicting groundhog.
As the sky shines bright above me, my shadow I see beside me. 6 more weeks of winter it will be.
Come on, the weather is all in your mind, okay? It's all in your mind. We're going to talk more about groundhogs and the movie in just a moment. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Then put your little hand in mine.
So what do you do when you're going to have a religious ceremony? You sacralize the space. Listen to that music. Sacred music, no. It's Sonny and Cher, but it is the music that iconically evokes that moment at 6 a.m. when Bill Murray wakes up again and again and again in the movie Groundhog Day. It is Groundhog Day today, and the holiday is not what we're going to talk about, but the movie is something we're going to talk about because the movie has become, since it was released in 1993, something of a cult legend, and for reasons that we're going to explore. I mean, it does ask all the right questions.
Rita, if you only had one day to live, what would you do with it?
I don't know, Phil. What are you dying of?
No. I mean, the whole world is about to explode. What do you do?
I just want to know where to put the camera.
Asking big questions, kind of a romantic comedy, but also having this spooky sort of deja vu, it happens over and over and over again kind of special effect, transported this movie, for reasons we don't quite understand, into something way beyond simply a cult flick or a vehicle for Bill Murray. Angela Zito joins us. She's co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. She's right here in the studio. Angela Zito, is this a parable of redemption, and why do religious groups identify with this text and this story?
Well, I guess I'd say the quick answer to that one would be yes. And what's interesting is that so many different groups seem to identify with it. I myself have taught the film at the end of an Introduction to Buddhism class.
Really?
So, yes. So that is the angle at which I come to it.
So but list the religions, the many religions you say that have adopted this story or have at least investigated.
Well, Jews seem to be very interested in it. Certainly Christians. I've heard Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog himself, you know, compared to the risen Christ sort of out of pagan traditions, you know, the rising of spring, so on.
And there are origins there, absolutely,
yeah, absolutely
historical origins
that,
there.
Well, yeah.
Well, the stone tablets guy in this story is Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day. He joins us from Massachusetts. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, John.
So you didn't come down from the mountain with this screenplay, did you?
I actually did write it on a stone tablet. took a while.
Did you have any idea that this would be the result? I mean, you, Bill Murray, I don't necessarily associate you guys with you know, a religious cult or...
You just don't know us well enough.
I know.
No, of course not. I mean, it was just trying to be honest with the original premise of the story and being honest to the character, and that's, you know, it was very gratifying that it was embraced by so many people in that way because we knew it wasn't just a simple comedy.
Now, how did you know it wasn't just a simple comedy? What told you that?
Well, when I came up with the idea, I wasn't interested in the premise as a simple comedy about a guy just repeating the same day, even though I knew that that was funny and had a lot of good ideas in it. It wasn't until I started thinking about people and humanity, and it was always a young man's journey through life. If a person could live long enough and unencumbered by history, what would be the result? How would they change? So at the very heart of it, it was always a very human story.
And that really is the classic core of this story, Angela Zito, someone who gets the chance to relive their life and what they might do differently. That's sort of the redemption.
Well, it certainly is about repetition, and religions think about repetition somewhat differently. Buddhists of the Mahayana greater vehicle tradition, that's like Zen, Tibetan Buddhists, so
right.
on, they think that we are all here until we manage to get it right. So there will be constant reincarnation.
So there it's the repetition. It's, yeah. The repetition is that's interesting. So it's not simply corrective, it's improvement.
It's improvement.
Interesting.
And you get the chance over and over again. First of all, to notice that you're repeating, and this is something that Bill Murray does notice. No one around Bill Murray notices that the day is repeating.
And when he finally comes to a conclusion of what the heck is going on here, here's what he concludes about himself. Listen.
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god. I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
So, Danny Rubin, you wrote that line. Were you thinking Job there, or were you thinking Terminator?
Oh, well, I was just thinking that was his character with his kind of ego would come to that conclusion and then kind of grow beyond it to the point where he realized, well, I may be a god, I may not be a god, it doesn't matter, I'm still stuck here. There are still limitations to what I can do.
You know, Danny, you were saying that you were just examining the character, but, you know, the funny thing for me is the place where it actually realistically becomes about a religion is that he has to get it right to a certain extent. Like, you're looking for the right answers from him before the whole roller coaster ends. He's going to keep doing it over and over again till he says the right things and does the right things. There's a right answer here.
I don't know if that's true, but it sure seems that way because of where the movie ends.
Right.
What if the movie went on for another 2 hours?
See, that's what I was afraid of when I watched it.
Really, most people enjoy it.
No, I totally enjoyed it, but I trying to imagine this repetition, I went, this feels like it might be a prison. How's he going to deal with that? Of course, you dealt with it brilliantly. Angela Zito, what is the most unusual sort of interpretation that you found in your teachings?
Apparently it is considered to be really a kind of mandatory viewing for Wiccans, because Groundhog Day is one of their, you know, four-time Sabbath holidays, like the holidays that come during the year between the equinox and the solstice.
Now, remind us who the Wiccans are. Well, they're not witches, are
not
they?
Witches. These are people who are interested in old pagan gods of say Northern Europe.
And was that the elevator pitch, Danny Rubin? We're going to get the Wiccans when we did this movie.
That's the one that got the studio on board.
Well, it's amazing. Congratulations, Danny Rubin. Happy Groundhog Day. I imagine it's a popular holiday in your household.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day, and Angela Zito, thanks so much for coming into the studio. She's co-director of the NYU Center for Religion and Media. Man, I had no idea that would be as interesting as it was. So I'm wondering, if Groundhog Day has been an important film to you, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or maybe there's another film out there that's been a big part of your life. Maybe The Big Lebowski or anything else. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We got to reach the Wiccans. Wiccans, call us.
We're also looking for your suggestions on how you help people that are unemployed. What do you offer to friends or family who've lost their jobs? Or if you are unemployed, what kind of help do you want?
This is Jim Corbett from Teaneck, New Jersey. Being that I'm unemployed, I went to a vocational counselor for advice, and he told me to try being a volunteer, that I get experience. That may be true, but with all due respect, volunteerism won't pay the bills.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the website, thetakeaway.org. We're also asking you about the Super Bowl. We're teaming up with ProPublica to find out what politicians are going to the Super Bowl and how they got their tickets. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You can report this, and we'll report the results on the website. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.